Our main speaker tonight, happy to introduce none other than Al.
My name is Al. I'm an alcoholic. And congratulations to the chip takers. And thank you for your service. When I walked in here, Rita says, "Looks like you're going to church." This is my church, baby. Okay, this is my church. Okay, this is what keeps me. This is where I made that connection. Okay. I really hate going over what it was like, because I'm not that guy anymore. You know, and I worked hard not to be that guy anymore. But I grew up in Berkeley, California, and the bad side, you know, what some of you folks would call the hood. And I was pretty reserved person until I got to be about 10 years old, you know, and you know, where I grew up, you know, a lot of times you had to fight your way out of that place as a kid, you know, and I started doing that, you know, and I was told by my mother and my brother that I had to do that to survive where we were at, and so I did. You know, but, you know, I took it as having permission to act that way, not permission to defend myself. And, you know, and ugly things happened. You know, ugly things happened. And I got in trouble a few times as a kid. And in school, I got in trouble, and I got sent to an elementary school to a guy that was like a coach for every grade there, and I got sent to him, and he started me off on a journey that really enlightened my life. You know, my dad left when I was 2 years old. I was the only kid in that neighborhood who didn't have a dad, you know, and it was that question was asked a lot. I'm left-handed, so the left hook came out a lot, you know, and I had, you know, later on when I got sober, I had fear of confrontation because it was embarrassing to be the only kid without a dad on that block. And, I had no clue what I was going to talk about tonight. You know, I always pray for God to speak through me, you know, and hopefully I'll touch somebody tonight. But I ended up playing ball. This coach had me. I had never played baseball, and this coach had me play baseball with the other bad kids that got sent to him. And he had his little star pitcher throw me some pitches, and I hit it over the wall. You know, it was a big bungalow there, and I went over there and over the fence, and he said, "Let me see you do that again," and I did it again. And this guy told me to meet him down at James Kinney Park, which was in Berkeley, and on a Saturday, and I said, "Well, I might come there, man, but I don't like baseball," you know. And he said, "No, you meet me down there," and, you know, so I went down there, and he said, "They're having tryouts that day." And so they had tryouts, and they have you do all the stuff, you know, and you hit and throw and run. And I was the very first pick, and I'd never played. And so later on, I realized I had a God-given talent, you know. It wasn't me, you know, that just did it, you know. So, you know, and yet I had trouble with this God thing as I was growing up. You know, I grew up Catholic, and my mom and brothers and sisters, I was the youngest, and we'd all walk to church, and, you know, and I tried to ditch them when we were walking to church, and always got in trouble for that. I got in trouble at church, and, you know, and until one day she just told me, she says, you know, she says, if you don't want to come here anymore, you don't have to. You know, and I think part of it, she was just disgusted with me. And, you know, she didn't have to ask me twice. You know, she told me that, and I went one way, and they went the other, and they continued to go to church, and I continued to go play baseball. You know, that was my new passion, my new love. And, you know, the story gets ugly, man. You know, and I just don't like telling it. You know, but I'll fast forward, you know, to high school. And when I got out of high school, I went straight to AAA and played AAA ball for about that long. And I was the young guy, the rookie, and all this stuff. And I was sent to the store to get some more booze. They told me what store to go to, and, you know, and I was only, God, just turned 18 years old. I was 17 when I got out of school. And I went, and I got all the booze, and I was high, and I was drunk, and I walked out in front of a car. And I got hit by a car, and there went the baseball career, you know. And I really think, for me, that's where the spiral started. You know, the shame, the guilt, the remorse. I remember telling my mom, you know, I'm going to get you out of here. You know, I'm going to get you out of here, you're going to live in a big, beautiful house, and you know, and two guys that I played ball with, and went to AAA also. You know. A couple of years later, I'm watching them on TV play professional baseball for a couple of different professional teams, you know, and I drank with those guys when we played ball in high school on traveling teams, you know, and they made it and I didn't, and I came back and I knew a lot of people when I came back, you know, there was people that had sponsored us and stuff, and I came back and. The first thing I did, man, is you know, I went where I knew I could make money, because I knew if I could make money, you know, I thought people would respect me more. You know, I thought people looked at me as a failure. You know, I was filled with shame, and I felt I had let my mom down. And my mom had my back. My mom always had my back. When I told her I was an alcoholic, she says, "No, mijo, you're not that bad." You know? You know? You know, and I had to convince her, "No, Mom, I am that bad," you know? And on her deathbed, you know, I talked to her, and me and her were just talking, just me and her one night. And she told me, "You keep going to those classes." That's one of the last things she said to me, was, "You keep going to those classes." You know, and when she was dying, I lived in Fresno, and I was able to go up and spend a few months with her before she died, you know, and I got my 20-year chip up there, and I was able to show her my 20-year chip, and then my birthday is a month after that, and me and my wife really think she was hanging on for the birthday, because she said she, you know, she wanted to make it then, and so September 1st, my birthday was the 21st, and I talked to her that night, and I told her, "You made it, Mom, you made it," you know, and it was September 1st, and I talked to her and told her what a good mother she was, and all the hell I put her through, you know, and she, how she always had my back, and she died the next day, you know, and that woman, she made me the man I was, you know, and then I went astray, you know, and I know I put her through a lot of heartache and pain, because I have kids too, you know. And I know, as a parent, when you have kids, man, their pain is your pain, you know. And I don't like that. It doesn't feel good when your kid is in pain over their kids, or, you know. And there's absolutely nothing you can do but pray for them. You know, I've learned what none of your business means unless you're asked. and that's a hard one. You know, I've been arrested several times. I've been to jail a couple times. You know, and it wasn't in the drunk tank. You know, and I was a conductor for Santa Fe Railway. And in 1990, I got in a train accident, and I had operations on my left knee for 3 years. And they wanted to operate on my shoulder, but I didn't let them operate. I was telling Maceo this before the meeting. And I said, they wanted to operate on my shoulder and my knee. And I asked the doctor, I says, if you do the shoulder and the knee, will I be able to get it around? And he goes, well, not really. And I said, well, just do my knee, don't do my shoulder. I still have a bone sticking up today. And the reasoning for that was because I wouldn't be able to get to the bar if I had both and I couldn't get around. That's the honest to God truth. That's the grip that alcohol had on me. And it wasn't just alcohol. You know, I left Berkeley when I was still fairly young. I was... the first time I was, I think, 27 or 28. And I moved quite a bit back and forth the first few years. And then I left there, and I left there because I had come down with hepatitis. You know, I was doing other things, but I was making a lot of money. You know, I had this job that paid better than any job around. You know, in 90, I was making over $100,000 a year, which was good money then, you know. But I didn't work a whole lot for the railroad because you could work as much as you want at that time or take up 14 days off if you wanted to, you know. And they had a call board to fill your vacancies and stuff. And I was making illegal money. And the illegal money was so good that I worked more at the illegal job than I did at the regular job. It ended up in me at one time getting stabbed, being in ICU for 17 days, waking up with my mother by my side, and me telling her, Mom, I seen Papa. That was my grandfather. I seen Papa, Mom. And I remember her saying, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? I seen Papa, Mom, I died. One more time. No, you didn't, mijo, you didn't die. And I said, Mom, I know I did, I seen Papa. And she said, how'd you know? You know, she wanted to know how I knew that I had passed away for a second. You know, and I just told her, what I seen. You know, and I don't know what the brain does, you know, when you go or whatever, but I really believe I've seen my grandfather to this day, you know, and he was the man in my life at one time, but then he died when I was 13 years old, you know, I was the kind of alcoholic because, you know, when you're good in sports, you get awfully cocky, you know, and I was awfully cocky, and I was awfully arrogant. I even had a restaurant in Berkeley that had my picture on their wall playing baseball, you know, and I thought that was so cool until I got hit by that car and I came back and I couldn't even walk in that place because I thought I'd be an embarrassment. That's how the shame haunted me. See, and, you know, I seen my father one time and it was when he had, I was still a kid, I had to be maybe 12 years old, and there was a knock at the door, and I remember my mom answering the door, and him shoving his way in the house, and I hadn't seen him since I was 2 years old, you know, and shoved his way in the house, and he was drunk and stumbling, and he pushed her, and I remember running upstairs and getting a baseball bat and coming down and beating the hell out of that man because he had laid his hands on my mom. And I bloodied him up pretty good. And me and her, you know, drug him out to the front, and she called the cops. You know, And all these things happened, man. And you know, I had nowhere to turn. I had no, you know, the male figure in my life that was my grandfather. He passed away, and I didn't have any, you know, any guys to turn to other than the guys on the streets. You know, they tried to tell me how, you know, you have to be tough, man. You don't take any stuff, man. We make the rules. You know, and. You know, I think of the 10th step when I say we make the rules. You know the 10th step. You know, the emotional sobriety thing I have talks about. You know how we want to control everything and everybody. You know, and you know that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to control everything and everybody, and that way I couldn't get hurt anymore. You know, nobody could abandon me. You know, but the way I did it was not suggested. You know, so anyways, you know, the last time I got arrested, what got me to Alcoholics Anonymous was I had gotten a large sum of money, and I was going through these surgeries, and this was in 1993, and I was going through surgeries. I'd been on my third surgery by then, and I took 10 grand and went from Fresno, where I was living, back to Berkeley. And I drank all the way there. I stopped at bars all the way on the way there. I'd drive so far. It took me, a 3-hour drive took me about 8 hours because I kept pulling off and stopping at bars, pulling off and stopping at bars. Then I got with my old buddies. We stayed up all night because we were doing that stuff that kept us up all night. And I drove back to Fresno the next day. I hadn't been to bed. And I did the same thing going back to Fresno. I stopped at every bar I could possibly stop at. And then I got back to Fresno and I went to a bar because I had met her and she was bartending there. And I told her when I'd be back and I was going to, you know, follow her to her place and hadn't slept in a couple of days, and on the way to that bar, a motorcycle cop went the other way, and he looked at me, and he kept looking at me as he went by, and he kept looking at me, and I'm in this big old Cadillac, man, and I rolled down the window, and I flipped him off, and he turned around, and he came after me, and the chase was on. You know, the chase was on. I was going down one street. He's going down another. I ditched my car. I got out, and I thought I had gotten away, and the helicopter lit me up. The helicopter lit me up, and a bunch of cop cars came around, and they were telling me I was so out of my mind, and they were telling me to drop what I had my keys twirling them like that, you know, and I had my hands up, and I'm twirling them. And they're telling me to get on the ground, and I'm just twirling them. And some guy came, one of the cops came, and he grabbed me, and he took me down. And he told me, he says, "I just saved your life." Yeah. You know, and he did. I believe he did. You know, and there I went. That's what got me here. There I went, and there was a lot of other incidences in that. And I got a lawyer. And this is how God works. Even though, you know, back then there was no God. You know, why God? Why'd you let this happen to me again? You know, that's all I said, you know. But I did pray. I told people I never used to pray. But I did pray, you know, God, get me out of this one. And this time really I'll straighten up, you know. You know, I mean, you know. You know, and, you know, that's, I did, you know. And the cop that was taking me to jail, he had arrested me before in Fresno, and I hadn't been in Fresno that long, and this guy knew me by my first name, and he told me, and he told me they were going to put you away this time, and you ain't going to see daylight for a long time, you know, and I remember him telling me that, you know, and I just listened to him, man. In Fresno, they had the old jail back then. We used to call it the dungeon. And they took me there. They booked me in, and they took me down there. And I had hidden some stuff on me, and they didn't find it. And they put me in the dungeon. This place was so old, the walls were falling apart, you know, and there was stone down there. And I dug out a little piece, man, and I stuck that stuff in there. And then by the time they were giving me a cavity search and everything else, I was clean. I had nothing on me. So I went and I got a lawyer. I called up a couple of people. My ex-wife, you know, which I left that whole part out. My ex-wife, who had had enough, she worked in the system. And she seen that I was in jail. And she reached out to me. You know, and she wanted me, she knew, you know, the bail's bonds and all that. And she had prisoners, women prisoners, released to her, and she'd get them back into society at the time. And she had came to the jail and talked with me. And she told me if I put up so much money for bail that she got this bail bondsman that she was good friends with that would get me out. And I said, I'm not putting this money up to get out on bail. You know, I said, there's no way. You know, and man, I had a lot of charges. And my bail, God, it was just over 100,000. And I just told her, there's no way. And she told me, give me $1,000 and this guy will do it for $1,000. And I said, I'm not doing it. And so she was going to put it up, she did put it up, so I paid her back. And I got out and paid her back, and I got a lawyer. And this is how God works. I got this lawyer, and he was showing me how many years I was going to do. He said, we're going to drag this out and drag this out and drag this out. And let me rewind, because by this time, I had custody of both my boys. Yeah. I had custody of both my boys, and the youngest one, when I got arrested, he had to be about 3 and a half. I got him when he was 2. You know, the other one was 12 years older than him. And I had custody, and I called up old mom again, you know, and I had to let her know that, you know, she might be taking care of another kid. You know, if she would, you know, and I knew she wouldn't say no, you know, and things, I mean, things really hit me at that time, you know, and I'll tell you the truth. When I got those boys, I got them just a few months apart. And when I got them, I was a bachelor man, and I was hitting the bars, and I was dating all the time. And I was having a great time. You know, I had my own place and you know, I had parties there, and you know, and my God, you know, I met her every other week. You know, I fell in love 6 times a month, you know, and you know what, man, it was insane. It was insane. You know, this lawyer, he told me, he says, I want you to go to AA meetings. And I said, AA meetings? I said, I don't know about that, you know. And I went with a friend of mine one time to support him. I thought it was just a joke, you know. And I remember telling him, that is not for me. And so this lawyer, he says, I'm going to drag this thing out. He said, we're going to have to drag this thing out. He said, I'm going to date the judge, take him to lunch. He says, I'm going to get, you know, he says, but this is going to take a long time. And it took a long time. And he told me where to go to the AA meeting. The first AA meeting I went to was a place called Sierra Fellowship in Clovis, California. And it had windows like this, you know, on top. And I remember I went to the meeting and I looked through the window and seen you guys in there. And I looked through the window, man, and I'm looking out there. I said, okay. And I go get in my car and I drove back home. And I went the next day and I look out in the window again. And, okay. So I get in my car and I drove back home. And I remember I had to go see the lawyer. And he says, you going to those meetings? I said, yeah, I've been to 2. You know? He says, have you met so-and-so yet? I said, well, no. He says, well, what about so-and-so? And I said, no, I didn't know he lived right across the street from these meetings. And he said, what meeting did you go to? You know, and I said, well, I didn't go inside. You know, I said, I just looked through the window. You know, and he chewed me out, you know. You want me to be your lawyer? You want me to fight this case? This is what you're looking at. And he showed me 2-5. He said, you're going to do 2-5 this time. And, you know, I just, man, you know, because I had bought my way out every time I got arrested before. And it worked. I had always bought my way out. And this time it wasn't happening. I wasn't buying my way out. And so, you know, I'll fast forward. And so I start going to meetings. You know, I went in to this meeting and the meeting was over and I go out to the parking lot and this guy comes running out and he has the blue book in his hand. And he says, hey, hold on, you know. And I thought, oh man, here comes the crunch. This guy wants a donation. You know, he wants a donation and he wants me to, you know, join this thing or whatever, you know. And I told him, I said, no, I'm just here, you know. I said, I'm here, you know, I'm fighting a case. And blah, I'm telling him the whole thing. He goes, yeah, we got a lot of you in here, you know. And he introduced himself and he says, here, that's okay, man. You know, that's okay. You go ahead. I don't need it. And he gave me the blue book, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. So I took it home and I had a recliner at home. I sat it on this little table next to the recliner and that book stayed there. And every morning when I got a cup of coffee, I'd drink that cup of coffee and that big old blue coaster I'd sit in my coffee cup on. And it stayed there. It stayed there. And then I started hearing things in the meetings. And you people would come up and you people would say, hey, how you doing? You know, what's your name again? I said, it doesn't matter. You know, and they says, and they would go, well, hey, you come, hey, don't do that. You know, they'd go to hug me. And I'd, no, don't hug me. I said, you can shake my hand, but don't hug me. You know, but she can hug me, and she can hug me. She can definitely hug me, you know. And this big old guy, Jerry L., he would just sit back and look at me, and he'd walk up. And right when he'd walk up, I'd put my hand out, and he was a big guy, and he'd just push it away, and he'd lunge in, and he'd pull me to him and give me a big old hug. You know, and there was this guy, Cruz, in there. And I would tell him, I said, you know, and I don't cuss in meetings, I really don't. But I would tell him, but I did it first, bad. And I would sit back and I says, you know what, see that guy right there, man, that big guy? I said, I bet I could knock his you-know-what out. I said, I bet I could, Cruz. You know, and that's how I looked at him, man. And that guy became my sponsor. You know, he became my sponsor. And him and this other guy that had a patch over his eye and the face was kind of twisted, because he tried to blow his head off and it didn't work. And that was my grand sponsor. And his name was Matt G. And he was a circuit speaker. And Jerry L. had spent 16 years in the penitentiary. Matt G. had spent a few. Matt G. had shot a cop and got off on a technicality. And he made an amends to this cop, and him and this cop became good friends. And you know, and I watched those two guys in this meeting I went to every Saturday, and it was a men's stag, and those two guys were the most content, happiest guys in the room. And that's when I thought, you know, I would read, you know, where it says restored me to sanity. I looked at that one day and I said, restored me to sanity. I thought it said insanity. You know, I could do insanity. I could do it very well. And I looked at that, you know, and then when me and Jerry, I was telling my wife, I was the only guy, because Jerry, man, he was tough, you know, and I said, I was the only guy that he sponsored that didn't do the steps because I didn't like you people. I wasn't going to do the steps like you people did, and so I didn't do them for almost 2 years. And what got me to do them was I went back to court, and I'm still fighting this case. They lost the frickin' evidence. And this deal that I had signed was off the table. One more time. You know, one more time. I had this kid, man. I wasn't going to have to leave him, you know. I wasn't going to have to leave either one of them. They gave me a different deal, and I hated it. He says, you're going to go to rehab for 6 months. And I asked the judge, and my lawyer says, every time the judge says something, he says, you just look at me. If I nod, you tell him, yes, Your Honor. If I do that, you say, no, Your Honor. And so everything was, yes, Your Honor, yes, Your Honor, yes, Your Honor. He says, and you're going to go to rehab for 6 months, and, you know, and you're going to have two probation officers, you know, one for alcohol, one for drugs. And he says, and then you're going to report back to me. And I did like this, and I says, Your Honor, I says, can I ask a question? He says, yeah, what's that? And I asked him, I says, can I do jail instead? And don't negotiate with the judge if you ever go if you ever go to court. It's not a pretty sight. So, you know, after he was finished ripping me up one side and down the other, you know, he let me know that I was going to rehab, and I had 2 days to get this probation thing straight, and I was to report to rehab, and that's where I went. And after 6 months, I was evaluated with an anger problem, so they tacked on 3 more months, and I was in rehab for 9 months, and I really, really thought that that's all I needed, you know, that's all I need. You know, I'm going to get out of here. I haven't drank or used for all this time. And those guys were coming to the rehab. You know, they were doing the H&I work. And when I got out, I remember walking down those stairs. And the first thing I thought was, Ron and Larry's bar is just a few blocks away. You know, after telling myself, this is good, I'm not going to drink, you know. You know, I didn't think about going to see the boys. You know, I thought about Al. It was all about me, you know, selfish, you know. And so that car pulled up with Jerry and Matt and a few other guys. And they said, and Matt was the one I used to think, how does he know? And he says, get in. We're going to St. John's for the noon meeting. I said, oh, that's okay. And he says, no, get in. He says, we're going to go and get, he says, you could get a drink after that. And I thought, how did he know? You know? And you know what? They took me there, and I went to that meeting. And they took me home, and I got my, you know, made my phone calls, and my boys got brought back to the house. And those guys saved my life. They picked me up. They would just walk in the house. You know, in Clovis, nobody locked their doors, man. And so they'd walk up, and they'd just walk in. I go, what are you guys doing here? We're going to a meeting at the Alano Club. Then I said, no, this was my out. No, my boy, he's only 5 years old, man. He has to go to bed at 8 o'clock, you know. No. They just keep walking by. They'd go in his room, man. They'd get some toys and stuff. And at the Alano Club, they had food, and they had a pool table. And then they had a couple different rooms for meetings. And they had a speaker meeting every Friday. So every Friday they'd show up, and that was the routine. They'd get my boy, and they'd entertain him. And I would want to go shoot pool, and they says, no, you're going in there. We'll be out here. And they would do that. And you know, they would watch him. You know, and I'd be in there in the meetings, and then pretty soon we started on the steps, and we started on powerless, and all Jerry wanted me to do was powerless on step one. You know, he said, just you know, write down, you know, how you're powerless over alcohol, and he goes, and it's a no-brainer how your life's unmanageable, right? Matt, he was a little more sarcastic than Jerry, and he would say, and by the way, he says, you stay out, it was raining, he said, you stay out here and you greet the newcomers. And I said, well, how in the heck do I know if they're newcomers? He said, if they can relate to you, they're a newcomer. You know, and this is how Matt was, and this is how they treated me. They treated me like this all the time. And then we, you know, we'd go over to Monterey, man. We went to a convention, and they showed me the convention, but I met her at the convention, you know. And me and her got lost, and then I went back to, you know, the motel the next day, and Jerry and Matt and those guys, they were gone. They left me in Monterey, you know, and I remember calling them and telling them how wrong they were, you know, and how they did me wrong and stuff, you know, and they said, you're a resourceful guy. Obviously, you made it back. You know, you don't need us. You know, you're doing it your way, you know, and I'd hear all that stuff, man. But I hung in there. I had to hang in there. You know, I had to go to meetings for the first 5 years. You know, probation was showing up to my house and I was being tested, and, you know, and I would tell them, I'll be here for 5 years. You know, that's no problem. I'll be here for 5 years. You know, and then, you know, I started to hear things in there. I started to hear things I could relate to. You know, and the best part was I told these people not to hug me, right? I told them, do not hug me. Hey, come on over for a barbecue, you know. Well, how do you barbecue without, you know, any alcohol? Man, come watch the football game without alcohol. You can't do that, you know. And I didn't go to anything. I didn't go to anything I got invited to because I didn't want to be around you people, you know. And I'll tell you what, they loved me unconditionally. They loved me until I could love myself. And I remembered, you know, when me and Jerry were working on the second step, you know, and I always say this, restore. You know, restore is to get back to your original form when you're restoring something. You get it back to its original form. And that stuck out. I wanted to be that guy so bad, it just wouldn't come out. It just wouldn't come out. And then I finally stood up after I went back to jail that time, and I went back to court over something else, and they threw me back in jail. And one more time, God was working there for me, but I couldn't see it. Because the only places I could go into, and they had me doing H&I, you know, if you want me to sponsor you, you have to do H&I. And the only two places I could get cleared on was God. Oh God, it was a place in Fresno, Fresno Karen Guidance. And it was a place where everybody was doing the Thorazine shuffle. And you'd go in that place and he said, just go in, you'll be in there for an hour, read the book to them, he says, and then leave. And I said, okay, so these people are pawing it on you when you're going in there. They're trying to touch you and pawing on you and you're going through there, you know. And so I read to him and I leave and I think, why does he have me coming here? These people don't even know I'm here. And then I was going to juvenile hall. And back then, you didn't need anything to get cleared for juvenile hall. I couldn't get cleared for any place. And so I was going to juvenile hall. And when I went to court, and this was on something else, and when I was leaving, the bailiff called me up there, and he goes, come here. And I looked at the computer he had, and he goes, this is you. And there was a $10,000 warrant out for me. And I said, yeah, that's me. And, you know, right there, man, he said, well, you know the routine. And I just dropped my arms, and he cuffed me up. He told me the band from Wasco was coming with the short-timers, and they'd be picking me up. And that pissed me off. And I let him know he pissed me off, you know. And ran into that man later down the road and was able to make an amends to that bailiff. Because it says when the opportunity presents itself, and it did. And I made amends to that guy. And I think I had like 7 years at the time. And I said, "Do you remember me?" And he goes, "Oh yeah, I remember you." I told him I'd like to make an amends to you. You know, I'm working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he encouraged me, man. And he said it was good to hear. You know, and he said keep doing it. You know, and anyway, so I went to those two places, and I got thrown back in jail for that. And unbeknownst to me, there was two people that worked at those two places, working at the county jail also. And on behalf, they spoke to the judge, and they let me out. Yeah. But something happened in that van on that ride, because you're all shackled together. You know, everybody's doing the shuffle together. And on that ride, I seen a man walking with his son. And that hit me, man. That hit me, and it put a lump in my throat, you know, because when I got those boys and I was that bachelor that was doing his thing and people were over my house all the time and, you know, and I was out there chasing women and, you know, I told people, you know, why do I have to get these boys? You know, I looked at them as a liability at the time, and I'm ashamed to say that, you know. They were a blessing. They were the biggest blessing I had gotten in my life up to that time. You know, and by the time I seen that man walking with that, I had already realized that because I was being taken through the steps. You know, I told my sponsor when we got to the third step on, you know, well, you know, I really have, you know, a problem with the prayer thing, man. And he said, "I just want you to ask God to reveal himself every day." He said, "Every day you get up," he said, "just that's your prayer for the day. God, please reveal yourself to me." You know, I was too stubborn, man, to see that God had been revealing himself to me the whole time. You know, when I went to jail, he revealed himself to me. You know, I got out because of the things I was trying to do for my recovery. You know, they lost the evidence, man. I got another chance. You know, just all the little things that were happening, you know, and so, you know, I did the four step, and when I did the four step, I thought, oh, I can't tell this guy everything I did. This guy showed me family pictures of him on the yard of San Quentin with his brothers and cousins and all that, and I was afraid to tell him about some of the stuff I had did. That doesn't make any sense, you know. And so he said, "Al, I'm going to tell you something that I've never told anybody but my sponsor." And he shared something with me. And he said, "Anything you tell me, I'll take to my grave." And he shared some stuff with me that just blew me away. And then I shared what I needed to share with him on my fourth step. And I was with him the day he died. I was at his place. He was on hospice. And he told me by the time he died, I believe I had 12 years when he died. And I guess I was the longest sponsee he had up to that time. And this guy was such an example of this program, you know, that the church was packed. They had speakers outside, you know, and I mean, this guy, he was loved by all, you know, and if it wouldn't have been for him and Matt G, who me and my wife were heading out of town, and he had been sick, and I went and laid on his bed with him, and he had asked her if we could have some time, and she excused herself from the room, and I got in the car, and I says, "He's gonna die." And she goes, "What do you mean?" And I was pretty choked up, and I said, "He's gonna die." And we were heading to Napa, and by the time we got to Napa, he had passed away. But I knew he was gonna die because Matt didn't cry. And we talked, about how we appreciated each other in our lives, because he was a single parent also, you know, and he taught me how to be a single parent. Those two men taught me how to love myself and how to respect myself and how to respect you guys and to respect Alcoholics Anonymous. They told me the biggest relationship I was going to make in this program was with my higher power. You know, today I lean on my higher power. Today that's my go-to. You know, I brought some stuff to read, but I'll just tell you now because I only have 5 minutes. I like going to 99 in the 12 and 12, you know, which we call the St. Francis Prayer. And I like going to that a lot because if me and my wife are having a disagreement or something, and I read, it's better to be understanding than understood, or it's better to, you know, to comfort than to be comforted. You know, the big baby that I am, I want to be comforted. You know. And, you know, and then it talks about forgiveness. You know, and those three things pop out at me. And then if that isn't doing the job, I'll go to 418, not 417. Because 418 talks about when he first met Max and, you know, and me, it's when I first met Andrea, you know, and all the things that stood out to me that I seen about her that made my life light up, you know, and all the laughter we shared together, you know. And it's kind of hard to stay mad at your loved ones when you're reading these books and you're practicing this, you know. And another thing, and we never go to bed without saying I love you. We never get off the phone without saying I love you. Me and my kids never get off the phone without saying I love you, you know. My grandkid who lived with us for a while, he's having his struggles right now. He's around all his buddies, man. He turns around, I'm leaving. And he got all his buddies. I couldn't do this at his age. And he goes, love you, Papa. Comes up and gives me a hug, you know. Yeah, you know. That's the blessings of this program. You know, that is the blessings. I'm going to end with this. I want to read something to you guys. I hope somebody got something out of this because I was all over the place tonight. Let me see. Where are we at? I had a good friend of mine in the program. And being the level-headed guy that I was when I first came into rooms, a bunch of guys had to break us up from having a fist fight. This guy's name was Dennis Appel. God bless him. He came into my life, and we literally couldn't stand each other and threw blows at each other. And he got cancer, and he came by my business one day, and he told me about it. And I says, hey, man, I says, you know, if you need to talk to anybody, I said, just give me a call. And that's how we started our relationship. We prayed together. And then he asked me if I would go through that journey with him. And I went through that journey. And every night before I left, he would ask me to read this. And I would read other parts of the book, but this is what I left with every night. I only get choked up when I talk about him. I could read this any other time. Anyways, and for me, I have 30 years, so it says the last 15, but every year I read this on my birthday too, and I like to put my increments of sobriety. So the last 30 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I've had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, because that is life. But also I have known a great deal of joy and a peace that is handmade of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related. First through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings, without obligations, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and never need return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys of the kingdom. I read that every night in the night that he took his last breath. You know, I have a necklace on, and his sister said, here, Dennis wanted you to have this, and I haven't taken it off since he's given it to me. You know, those are the gifts I have been given in this program. You know, I am truly grateful that I've gotten sober. I have 30, my sobriety date's 8/24/93. I can't say enough about this program. I could talk for 2 more hours about this program, you know. So I love all of you guys in here, and there's not a damn thing you can do about it. Thank you.
Thanks, Al. Let's give Al another hand.